As you probably know, this evening we're going to look at the Middle East and the return of Christ. And we're kind of taking a break for just a couple weeks here from our study in Romans, and I'm anxious to get back to Romans. But I want to look at this, and let me turn to Zechariah 12. That's the passage that's in your bulletin. Now, let me be clear. I'm not going to go through Zechariah 12 today, tonight. That's not my purpose. But I am going to read Zechariah 12 to begin. And the significance of Zechariah 12, if I can just summarize the significance, why the events of Middle East are significant, is this reason. I mean, we can just say this and go home. I'll tell you why the events in the Middle East are significant in the return of Christ. Because God has a future for the Jewish people. Okay, that's why. That's why this is significant. Zechariah 12 is a chapter that describes events in the future. It's not referring to the church. It's not referring to us. It hasn't happened yet. It's going to happen. Okay, so I want you to remember that as you read it. Now, the fact that let me read it. I'm not going to try to explain everything that's in this passage. I just want you to understand that this is fundamentally speaking about future things. Zechariah 12 says, "The burden of the word of the Lord concerning Israel. Thus declares the Lord who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I am going to make Jerusalem a cup that causes reeling to all the peoples around. And when the siege is against Jerusalem, it will also be against Judah. It will come about in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will be severely injured, and all the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. In that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with bewilderment and his rider with madness, but I will watch over the house of Judah while I strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. Then the clans of Judah will say in their hearts, a strong support for us are the inhabitants of Jerusalem through the Lord of hosts, their God. In that day, I will make the clans of Judah like a firepot among pieces of wood, and a flaming torch among sheaves, so they will consume on the right hand and on the left all the surrounding peoples, while the inhabitants of Jerusalem again dwell on their own sites in Jerusalem. The Lord also will save the tents of Judah first, so that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem will not be magnified above Judah. In that day, the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day will be like David, and the house of David will be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. And in that day I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn." By the way, that's describing there the conversion of the Jews when they see Christ and they believe on him. This is the one-third that makes it through. And they see Christ and they believe in him. I want you to go back sometime, not right now, but go back and read Isaiah 53 and realize that Isaiah 53 is the Jews' testimony when this happens. It says, "We," is referring to the Jews. The Jews are the ones who look back and say, "We esteemed him smitten of God, okay, but he was bruised for our iniquities." That day is coming when the Jewish people will see that Christ is their Messiah. Verse 11, "In that day there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadarimon in the plain of Megiddo. The land will mourn, every family by itself, the family of the house of David by itself, and their wives by themselves, the family of the house of Nathan by itself, and their wives by themselves. The family of the house of Levi by itself, and their wives by themselves, the family of the Shemites by itself, and their wives by themselves." All the families that remain, every family by itself, and their wives by themselves. Now again, I just read that as kind of an introduction to what we want to speak about this evening. We're not going to look at that in detail in Zechariah 12 tonight. But I want to introduce what we're going to be looking at, Lord willing, over the next few weeks. And when I say few weeks, you know how that is with me. It started out as 1 week, it turned into two, and I'm thinking it might be three. I really don't know. I don't want to go too long because I really do want to get back to Romans. But this is something that I've wanted to do for some time. And that is consider, in a kind of a brief way, the significance of what's going on in the Middle East in relation to prophecy. And the reason I wanted to do that, and I really want to do that, is fundamentally one reason. I want your eyes to be on the return of Christ. I really do. One of my prayers for myself personally each day is that the Lord would prepare me for His return, that I would always be looking for His return, that my eyes would be on Christ and on His return and not on this world. There's no antidote for worldliness like keeping your eyes on the return of Christ. Amen? It's true. If your eyes are in the world, I guarantee you, you don't have any interest in the return of Christ, and you're not looking for the return of Christ, and in your heart, secretly, you really don't want Him to return because you're enjoying this life. But when your eyes are turned from this world and you long for Christ, you want His return. You look for it. And my prayer is that for myself, that my eyes would be on Christ's return. I'm looking for His return. I often say this. I think the return of the Lord is near. I really do, for lots of good reasons. I'm looking for it. Okay, I really am. And I'm always looking for it, especially in this time of the year, because I really do believe these things are going to happen in the fall, because it's the fall feasts. You know, the spring feasts were fulfilled when He first came. I'm always thinking about this in the fall more than other times of the year. I expect the rapture is going to take place in the fall. I don't know that, but that's my... But all that to say, I want Ara, and I pray this for the church as well, that the church's eyes would be on the return of Christ. This is an important concept in the New Testament. But there's something else about this. This is part of the same reason, but, you know, as you know, I study the Bible for a living. I mean, it's what I do. I study the Bible. I study the Word of God. I love the Word of God. I love every part of it. But I will say that over the years, there is no study that has filled me with more worship of the Lord than the study of prophecy. I can't explain this. It's just so neat to me. It's so incredible. When you begin to see God's plan as it's laid out in the Bible, it's overwhelming. You say, God, You are amazing. And I want you somehow to see a little bit of that. There is an almost amazing disinterest in prophecy in the church. And this is especially true in the Reformed circles, but it's true generally. I don't understand it. I do understand it. They don't understand, and that's why they don't like it. The only reason most... Well, I won't get into it. But all that to say, it is a truly glorious study. And when I study these things, I am overwhelmed. When I go through the Old Testament and I see all these things come together, I say, this is amazing. I had one of those moments this morning, which I'll share with you in a minute. But all that to say, I want our church to be focused on the return of Christ, because that's the church. The church is to do that. The church is defined throughout the New Testament as waiting for the Son of God to return, as looking for His return, as waiting for His return, longing for His return, like a bride looking for her bridegroom, right? And it's a glorious thing. Well, I want us to be focused on that. And so I often, when I'm able to, I speak about the return of Christ. Now, so I've wanted to look at this for some time, but why now? And let me give you three reasons why I wanted to do it now. And the first one is a very purely logical reason. I guess all reasons are logical, but pragmatic, and that is we're starting the fall. This is a good time to do something like this. You know, we had a break over the summer. Before we get back into Rome, this is a good time to do it. So that is one reason. But really, the two main reasons for now doing it now is, first of all, because of what's going on in the Middle East right now. If you've read your paper at all over the last few months, over the summer, you know that the Middle East is like a powder keg. I mean, it truly is. I mean, what's happened in the last two or three months is amazing, okay? And it really is very volatile. And now, of course, over the last week or two, you've been reading in your papers, America's government, the media is preparing us for a war. That's obvious. You know, they always do this. You know, they're preparing us to attack Syria. It's going to happen. Okay, so we're going to do that. It's just a matter of when, I'm sure, when they put this much emphasis on it in the media. But you've been reading about this, you know, we're going to strike Syria. We're trying to get support to strike Syria. And, of course, if you hear anything in regard to prophecy, people are saying, you know, this is critical, this is big, whatever. And I'm convinced that a lot of Christians don't really know why. They just have a sense that it should be, but they don't really know why. I want to explain why. Why is this significant? Why is what's happening in the Middle East, not only now, but you know, for the last 75 years, why is it significant? By the way, I'm not here to tell you this is the end. Okay, I'm not here to tell you that World War III is going to start next week. It could, and I really believe that. It could. Okay, it's going to someday. Okay. And it's going to start there someday. But I'm not a prophet. You know, we've been hearing this for the last 50 years. I mean, I grew up hearing about prophecy. And to be honest with you, almost every year there seems to be a crisis in the Middle East that seems to be the last one. This is it. Okay, so I'm not here to tell you that this is the last crisis and it's going to, there's going to be a world war next week. What I am here to try to help you to see is the significance of what's going on there. Okay. It is significant. It's highly significant. It's biblically significant. So I want to explain why. Now, the other main reason that I wanted to do this now, or maybe this isn't the reason why, but it's a good, it just kind of worked out this way. What we've talked about the last few Sundays on the Transfiguration, which was amazing to me. I mean, as I've studied this, I was astounded just studying this. The nature of what the Transfiguration was teaching. And let me rehearse that real briefly, okay, because it's important. My, if you will, my understanding as I studied the Transfiguration in Matthew 17 is that Jesus was teaching his disciples that his second coming is the same thing as the Messiah coming in glory in the Old Testament. Now, that's highly significant, which I think I've tried to prove over about four Sundays. That's why we were in the Transfiguration for 4 weeks. Okay. In other words, what I believe Jesus was teaching his disciples through the Transfiguration was that he did not come the first time to fulfill the promises in the Old Testament regarding the kingdom. That would be fulfilled when he returns. You understand the concept of the second coming was totally new to the disciples. In fact, it tells us it was exactly 1 week old. He had told them a week before about his coming, and then he had the Transfiguration. So they were being told, I don't think they understood it at the time. I think they understood it looking back. But he was teaching them, and I think he's teaching us through the Transfiguration, that the Old Testament promises regarding the kingdom and regarding the salvation of Israel would take place at the second coming. Now, the reason that's so significant, I pointed this out on Sunday mornings, but you've got to understand this. When it comes to eschatology, when I say eschatology, I mean things of the end, the last days. Today, and especially in scholarly circles, the vast majority of evangelical scholars would basically say that there's nothing in the Old Testament that really informs us about the second coming of Christ. That basically Christ fulfilled the Old Testament promises when he came. Now, there's a paradigm that a lot of people have in their minds, which is false. There's an aspect of truth to it, but it's false. There are a lot of people that have, and this is especially true in Reformed circles, and I say that because it's kind of, I know that many of you have heard Reformed speakers and listened to Reformed speakers. You must understand that the paradigm in their mind, and I'm not going to go into it all, covenant theology and so forth, but the paradigm in their mind is Old Testament is all types, New Testament, fulfillment. Old Testament, types, New Testament, fulfillment. And that's their whole paradigm. Which means that basically Christ fulfilled whatever's in the Old Testament when he came the first time. And I want to argue that that's not what the Bible teaches at all. Now, it's true that Christ does fulfill many types in the Old Testament. That's a truth. But it's way oversimplifies the Old Testament. And all that to say, there are a lot of passages in the Old Testament that teach us about the second coming itself and what happens after the second coming. Okay? When it talks about the kingdom in the Old Testament, that's what happens when Christ comes again. Okay? So that's why I read Zechariah there, right? Zechariah, that's referring to the time of the end. It hasn't happened yet. Okay? Now, does that make sense? Okay, that's the whole issue of the transfiguration was part of the reason this fit in well at this time because of what I just went through. But this is kind of an aside, but I had one of those moments this morning as I was reading from the pulpit. Revelation chapter 7. I don't know if you caught this, but this is the first time I read Revelation 7 since I taught the Transfiguration. Did you notice the tabernacle, the Feast of Tabernacle references there? Look at that for just a moment. This is kind of an aside, but I was fascinated by this. I mean, this came to me as I was reading it. Now, you understand, Revelation chapter 7 is in the midst of the tribulation. The first part of the chapter speaks of the 144,000 Jews whom God is going to seal and who he's going to use. In other words, they're kind of come to Christ, I believe, early in the tribulation. God's going to use them to preach the gospel to the world. Now, notice what it says in verse 9 of chapter 7. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could count from every nation and all tribes and people and tongues. In other words, they are what? Well, they are, but you're right. But they're what? They're not Jews. They're Gentiles. They're from all over the world, right? Now notice what they're doing. Stand before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes and what? Palm branches. What is that? Feast of Tabernacles. That's what they did at the Feast of Tabernacles. See, this is the second coming. I mean, this is the victory, okay, that the Feast of Tabernacles was picturing. But notice, the thing here is these are not Jews, these are Gentiles. Can you say Zechariah 14? That's exactly what Zechariah 14 says, that when Christ returns, all the nations are going to keep the Feast Tabernacles. But now, I'm not going to read this whole chapter, but look, this is what they're saying. Look at verse 14, or verse 15. It says, "For this reason they are before the throne of God, and they serve him day and night in his temple, and he who sits on the throne will spread his tabernacle over them. They will hunger no longer, nor thirst any more, nor will the sun beat down on them, nor any heat." I mean, that's Feast of Tabernacles. That's exactly what was pictured in the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, "For the Lamb in the center of the throne will be their shepherd and will guide them to springs of water of life, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes." Well, that's just us on the side. But the point that we want to make is that the feast or the transfiguration, the teaching regarding the transfiguration is relevant to what we want to say. Now, let me just outline what I want to do in the next however many weeks. And, you know, however far we get. I'm not in a hurry. I never am. But, you know, I want to take time for questions if people have them. So I'm not going to rush through this thing. But at the same time, you know, I want to cover these four things. First of all, tonight, and this is going to be brief, but I just want to briefly run down the current situation in the Middle East. Now, I'm not a Middle East expert. I'm not pretending to be, okay? My expertise is in the Bible. I mean, that's what I study day and night. Okay. Now, my expertise is not in the Middle East, but I do want to run down just the current situation in the Middle East, why it's significant, what's happened in the last few months, and what is happening now. Then I want to give you a brief overview of biblical eschatology. That's why I gave you the chart, if you have the handout. And again, I'm not trying to prove this. I'm not going to go through it in great detail, but I do want to overview it and explain briefly where this comes from, why we hold to it, and so forth. Now, we can't really do the rest of it unless we give you the overview. Now, after we do an overview of biblical eschatology, then I want to speak about the relationship between the Middle East and the Second Coming. Why? What is the relationship? What is the significance? What is it that we're looking for? What is it that this could lead to? Okay, when we say this, you know, is looking like, you'll hear people say things like, well, this looks like things are really shaping up. What does that mean? Shaping up for what? Okay. What is the significance of the Middle East? What is specifically, what is it that we're looking at that is significant? Okay. And then lastly, and I think this is important, I want to give you a little bit of a rundown of the recent history of Zionism and the Middle East conflict. Give you kind of an outline overview. Because, and the reason I want to do this is because if you really want to understand anything, you have to understand the chronology of anything, any movement, any... I think one of the ways in which... I think one of the reasons many people are so in the dark about what's going on is because they're relatively ignorant of what has happened. May I remind you, I mean, really, most of the conflict in the world somehow is centered on the Middle East in the last 50 years, in some way, shape, or form. It's not always been like that. I mean, if you go back through world history, you know, the last 2,000 years, there's been very little conflict generally over the Middle East. It's something that has really taken place in the last 100 years. So if we're going to understand what's going on now, today, we have to understand where we've been in the last 100 years. And what is Zionism? Do you know what Zionism is? What is Zionism, and how did it develop? And who were the main people, and what were the main events? And, of course, we've had various attempts at bringing peace in the Middle East between the Jews and the Palestinians. And, of course, the press is inevitably very anti-Israel, which is somewhat ironic. This is kind of an aside too, but it's kind of ironic because there's no place in the Middle East that an Arab has more human rights than in Israel. I mean, not even close, okay? And yet, they treat Israel as if Israel is some kind of an apartheid regime or something. Israel is not an apartheid regime, okay? Now, I'm not defending Israel in the sense that they're in the state of unbelief. They're not believers in God, but they are the foremost promoters of human rights by far in the Middle East. They have the most sane government by far in the Middle East. I am amazed at the way in which the media and the intellectuals of the West have really, to be honest with you, created lies about what's going on. So you really can't trust what you're reading in your newspapers. There's a huge bias against Israel. But all that, we'll talk a little bit about the nature of the Middle East conflict and so forth. So having said that, let me then consider just briefly the current situation in the Middle East. Okay, I'll sum it up into four things. And again, I'm not an expert on these things, and I'm not an expert on what's going on. If you have read the headlines over the last 3 or 4 months, you know as much or more than I do probably in terms of what's actually happening now. But I do get a paper. I get the Wall Street Journal every morning, and I do read the headlines. I'm not a big paper guy. I don't read a lot of news, but I do try to keep up a little bit. And of course, this has been in the headlines throughout the summer in some way, shape, or form, the Middle East. And of course, the first thing that was of major significance, and I'm not sure the timing of this off the top of my head, but Iran, of course, and the question of them developing nuclear capabilities is a major aspect of what's going on in the Middle East. And there has been talk, really for years, but especially recently, about Israel actually striking Iran and trying to knock out their nuclear capability, and they claim, at least some of them do, that they could actually do this. That they could strike Iran and that they could destroy their nuclear capability. And of course, we don't know for sure exactly where they are in their nuclear capability, but this is certainly a major issue in the Middle East. And if Iran had nuclear capability, that would be a very serious problem. For the Middle East, it would be a serious problem for Europe and ultimately for the United States as well. Now, there's also, Iran has a new president, okay? We for months or years were hearing the tirades of I can never pronounce his name. I always have to think about it. Ahmadinejad. I can never pronounce it. I have to look at it like, okay, how do you say that? Yeah, we've heard him, you know, often, you know, his tirades against Israel, how he's going to destroy Israel and so forth. And, of course, his tirades against the West. Now, he's no longer president. As of August, he was replaced by Hassan Rouhani, but you have to understand that's really not that important because the president doesn't really run things in Iran. The head of the government is called not the president but the supreme leader of Iran, and he's been in business since 1989. So and that's Khamenei, Ali Khamenei. Sayed Ali Khamenei. And again, these pronunciations, you got to understand, I read this, I don't listen to it because I don't listen to TV, so I don't hear the pronunciations, I just read them. But at any rate, this is, he's the supreme leader, and he's been the supreme leader since 1990. So how do they get him in? There is apparently an assembly of experts who are Muslim theologians that vote in and basically are over the supreme leader. But he's been in since 1989. But the point is, the regime has not changed just because the presidency has changed. Okay, but Iran has always been or is a threat from that standpoint. And then there is something called the Arab Spring. Have you heard about the Arab Spring? The Arab Spring is basically a movement of protesting throughout the Arab world that kind of began in Tunisia in 2010 and has spread throughout many of the countries of the Middle East and has overthrown some governments. Basically, they are protests, some of them violent, some of them nonviolent, in various forms. They have protested the regimes that run the governments of the Middle East. And this has created a certain amount of violence. Of course, the one that was in the news the most this summer had to do with Egypt. And Mubarak, who was the president of Egypt, was ousted in 2011. And then there was his replacement, who was Mohamed Morsi. He came in, and then he was, what do they call it, a coup was basically in June, this past June, that overthrew him. And now we have a military regime. Now, none of these, by the way, it doesn't matter who's in there. I mean, Morsi was part of the Muslim Brotherhood radical group. All of these groups, no matter what they are opposed to Israel. Okay, none of them are friends of Israel. But at any rate, there's a great deal of unrest in Egypt, even now. And then, of course, most famously right now, it's Syria. Now, Syria has been ruled by Assad since 2000. And before 2000, his father ruled for about 30 years. And Assad has been dealing with a revolution or a civil war or rebellion or whatever you want to call it since about 2011. And the West has been threatening for some time to get involved somehow. And so now, of course, as you know from the headlines, the issue that kind of created this scenario was the fact that Assad supposedly used chemical weapons and killed some 1,400 citizens or something, protesters, rebels. We haven't seen the evidence for that. We don't know what it is, but our government says there is evidence that we have done this. It sounds a lot like Iraq, you know, when we get into Iraq. Well, we have, you know, we don't really know what the evidence is, but at any rate, our president is trying to gain support to go in and strike Syria. Why is that serious? Well, again, I'm not here to strike fear into your hearts or say this is the end of the world, but again, you know how wars start, and if you know the history of world wars, particularly World War I, you know this is how it starts. Someone says that if you do this, I'll do that, and if you do this, I'll do that, and that's basically what we have here. We have a scenario where Syria has said, listen, if you strike us, we will strike Israel. And Iran says that if you strike Syria, we will Well, they have threatened to do things in Iraq, but I understand they've also threatened to do things here. And of course, there's also Russia, who's building up in the Mediterranean. It doesn't take too much imagination to see how this could be a world war, literally overnight. Okay, that could happen. Okay, I'm not here to strike fear into your hearts. I am telling you reality. Okay, this is reality. And by the way, if this doesn't happen in this situation, believe me, it's going to happen. Okay? Do you really think we're going to avoid a World War III? Okay. Well, we know that we're not, because the Bible basically tells us. We know what the end is going to be like, and it's going to be full of war. Okay? War is coming. Okay? So, again, I'm not here to say this is it. God knows. But that's the current situation. Now, let me just stop there for a moment. Does anybody have any questions about what I said? I said a lot, I know, but I'll just give you a breather. Okay, does anybody have any questions? No? Okay. Yes, Paul. Well, thank you. But I'm not an expert on these things. By the way, the most reading I do, I have done a fair amount of reading, and I'm going to share some of this with you and maybe give you some suggestions to read, but I have done a fair amount of reading of the history of modern Israel, which I think, to be honest with you, I think that gives you a better understanding than to read the newspapers day by day. When you read the newspapers day after day, you're getting somebody's very biased opinion, you're getting half information, and you're really not getting the whole story. And if you really want to understand what's going on today, read what happened over the last 50 years, or last 100 years. History gives perspective. I pointed this out when I taught church history. History gives perspective on what's going on now far more than what newspapers do. I still agree with Thomas Jefferson. Let's see if I can remember what he said about. He said, how did he say? No one. Now I forgot what he said. He said something to the effect that no one is more ignorant than he who reads a newspaper. He says, no, he who reads nothing understands more than he who reads newspapers, or something like that. And I think he's right. Okay, I think that's true today as much as it was before. A lot of people think because they know facts and names and dates about what's going on right now that they understand. Okay, to understand, you have to understand history. You have to understand history. Any other? Someone else had a breathy? No? Somebody? Okay. Well, with that in mind, Len, and man, I'm already down to 15 minutes. Let me look at the chart. Does anybody not have the chart? Daniel, could you get one for your mother, please? Does anybody else need one? Okay, Kevin, we need two more, or one more. Now, again, let me just say this. If you're going to understand the chronology of the last days, okay, you have to study really two books. And it all comes from those two books. What are they? I'm talking about books of the Bible, okay? Daniel and Revelation. Almost all the time frame elements come from Daniel and Revelation. Now, lots of other details are filled in throughout the whole Bible, especially the prophets. But if you're going to understand the time frame, you must understand Daniel and Revelation. Now, I am not here to go through Daniel and Revelation. I am not here to explain how we get to this chart, although I'd love to do that. But you know that I would never get out of this thing. So let me go over it from left to right and just explain it, and if you have questions, you can ask me. Now, observe there are passages of Scripture here listed. These are not exhaustive. In fact, I've left out whole major passages. These are just representative of some of the passages that relate to these issues, to these subjects. Let me begin by saying a word about the church age. The church age is what we are in today. Okay, and the church age began with Pentecost. That's what defines the church, the coming of the Holy Spirit. And, of course, the Jews and Gentiles in one body. Okay, that is the church. Okay, the church, and again, not to go into all the theology of it or to express it or to go into the detail of the background to prove it, but the church is not Israel. The church is not the fulfillment of all the promises that were made to Israel. The church has not replaced Israel. The church is not mixed up with Israel. The church, okay, is a separate group, a separate body that partakes of the same covenant promises, but they are not the replacement of God's plan for the Jewish nation. Okay, now the reason I say that, you have to understand this. The reason that many today are leaving this eschatology, and they are, okay? In fact, most people would call me an ignoramus for even getting this out. I don't care, because I believe this is true, but the reason that in the scholarly world they've left this is because they have confused the church in Israel. If you look in the scholarly world, even in quote-unquote dispensational circles, if you go to Dallas Seminary, whatever, they have increasingly made the line between the church and Israel fuzzy. They have, in various ways. I mean, it comes across in different ways. In other words, there are different various theories. But listen, if you lose the distinction, which I believe is very biblical, between the church and the nation of Israel, the ethnic people of Israel, your eschatology will never make sense. You can't make sense of the eschatology in the Bible. You can't, okay? And you will, now if you maintain that distinction, which I believe can biblically be shown, this makes perfect sense, okay? Now, in fact, it works out beautifully. It's absolutely incredible. Now, the next thing that's on the timetable for the, in regard to prophecy, is the rapture. Now, again, a lot of people have left this doctrine today in scholarly circles because they've lost the distinction between the church and Israel. If you don't have a distinction between the church and Israel, you will never have a rapture happening before the tribulation. It doesn't make any sense. Okay, so I just want to make that clear. The rapture is described mainly, not only here, but mainly in three passages. John 14, 1 through 3, 1 Corinthians 15, 51 to 52, and 1 Thessalonians 4, 16 and 17. And what's most significant about the rapture is this. It's the church, it's resurrection, and it's people leaving the earth and going to Christ. Now, that's very important. If you look at John 14, remember what John 14 when Jesus said, "I'm going away," and you know, he tells them not to be worried. What did he tell them? "I'm going to what? Prepare a place for you, and then what? I will come again so that what? Where I am, there you may be also." In other words, we leave. What happens in 1 Thessalonians 14 when at the resurrection, or the resurrection of the saints? We go up and we meet the Lord where? In the air, in the clouds. Now, that's not the second coming. What happens in the second coming, Revelation 19? Jesus comes down and stays down. Matthew 24 and 25, Revelation 19. Okay, he comes down and he stays down. We go with him. We are the bride of Christ. That's the church. That's not, I do not believe that that's all the saints of the ages. That's the church. The church is the unique bride of Christ. And interestingly enough, in the Jewish wedding, the bridegroom would leave, go and prepare a place for his bride. He would come unexpected and unannounced. I mean, they knew she knew he was coming, but she had no idea when. He would come. He would take her away back to his house, and for 7 days they would have their honeymoon, or whatever you want to call it. They didn't call it that. Okay, now that's the picture. Okay, that's where we go. We go with the Lord for 7 years to glory in heaven, to the place he's prepared for us. Okay, now that's the rapture. And that's the next event. And it's very important to understand the rapture is imminent. In other words, it could happen at any moment. It could happen today. Okay, and so we're looking for the rapture. And I've often said, one of the reasons that I think the rapture, one of the things about the rapture I think is significant is the fact that, listen, are we not called throughout the Bible, I mean, isn't our hope the return of Christ? You know, what does, you know, Titus 2 calls it our what? Our blessed hope. Now, if there is no rapture, and we must go through the day of wrath, I mean, between you and me, I just assume the Lord wait to return to a little later. Let him come another time, okay? It totally changes the dynamics. And I would just assume that Christ didn't return in my lifetime, quite frankly. And it's true. If you read Revelation 6 through 18, I don't want to be here for that, do you? Okay? We are looking for the return of Christ. We long for the return of Christ. Listen, we're going to be delivered from the wrath to come, as Paul says in Timothy. That's the rapture. We're going to be delivered from the wrath to come. What is the wrath to come? He's not talking about hell there, Paul, in 1 Thessalonians. He's talking about the wrath that's going to be poured out on the earth at the day of the Lord. And that's called the tribulation. And the tribulation is a 7-year period. And again, this isn't exhaustive, but I have here three things about the tribulation. It's God's wrath poured out on the world, something that was promised throughout the Old Testament and New Testament. There is a coming a day when God's wrath is going to be poured out on the world, where, according to the book of Revelation, vast numbers of people will be killed via earthquakes, famines, wars, supernatural events. We're talking numbers like that are used in Revelation. A quarter, a third. Do you know how many people that is? That's billions of people are going to perish in a time that will be utter chaos, that will include a totalitarian one-world regime in the second half of it. Okay? This is the wrath. This is going to be part of the wrath of God that is going to be poured out on the world. Okay? This is one aspect of it. It is going to be also, this is something, again, prophesied throughout the Old Testament. It's in the book of Revelation as well. God is going to purge, that is, cleanse Israel. He's going to call Israel back to himself. He's going to do that through the period of Revelation, or through the period of tribulation. In fact, it's called, this time period is called in Jeremiah, Jacob's trouble. Notice, it's not the church's trouble. It's Jacob's trouble. Jacob is Israel. Israel has been in rebellion and unbelief all the way back, we read it right this morning in Deuteronomy 32. And when their Messiah came, they rejected him. And they have been in unbelief this whole time. God says, I'm going to take them through the wilderness. He uses that term in various places like Hosea and Ezekiel 20. I'm going to bring them through the wilderness, and I'm going to purge out the rebels. And the third, this is Zechariah chapter 13, the third that make it through are going to enter the kingdom, and they're going to believe on the Messiah. Okay? So that's part of the purpose of the tribulation. By the way, the Jews have had immeasurable persecutions. When you read about the history of the Jewish people, it is truly a very, very sad history. It is hard to even express what they have been through in the last 2,000 years. If you ever have an opportunity, in fact, there's a good book, I got it at Barnes & Noble's, An Atlas of Judaism, I think is what it was called. One of those books that cost $12, but it's worth far more than that. I read through the thing. And it's basically a history of it was a history of Israel all the way back to biblical times, but he went through all that they've gone through in the last 2,000 years. Unbelievable suffering. Everywhere they have gone, they have been hated, they have been scorned, they have been persecuted, they have been killed. They were killed during the Crusades, they were killed during the Inquisitions. Every nation they went to, they were expelled. They, in many places throughout Europe, throughout the Middle Ages, they were not allowed to have education. They were not allowed to have, they were not allowed to own land. They were not allowed to possess. They have been in incredible suffering all through the ages. And of course, most notably, we think of the Holocaust. But their worst sufferings are in the future, according to the Bible. And it's going to be this time, the time of tribulation. And the third thing that happens during the tribulation is the reign of Antichrist. And again, the Bible says a great deal about this. Let me just summarize it this way. Since the Tower of Babel, when God divided the nations, remember that, all the way back in Babylon, since that time, Satan has been trying to and is working toward undoing God's work at the Tower of Babel. In other words, he's trying to reunite the whole world under his king. Okay. Now, this is Psalm 2. Okay. In other words, there. By the way, I have to say this. I mean, biblically, okay, history, biblically, is a conspiracy. I know people don't like that word, but it is. It's a satanic conspiracy against God. It's a satanic conspiracy to bring about a one-world government. That's biblical. I mean, you know, that's what they've been doing since Babylon. Okay, they've been doing it through secret societies. Okay, and it will come to fruition. And I would suggest to you it's very close to fruition now. Okay. And according to 2 Thessalonians, the only thing that keeps it back is the fact that the church is here. Okay? But when the church is gone and when the rapture takes place, this is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it will come about. Okay? It's because they've been working on it for a long time. Okay? And what it is going to be is a totalitarian system. It's going to be a totalitarian government that controls all economies, all governments. Everything will be under one world dominion. Now, again, this is happening right before our eyes, the preparation for this. This is what Revelation 13 speaks of. This is what Daniel speaks of. Okay. Now, all of that takes place in the tribulation. I don't want to be here, okay, and I'm not planning on being here. This is not an escapist mentality. That's how people, you know, you just want to escape. Well, of course I want to escape. Who wouldn't? Noah wanted to escape the flood, didn't he? I mean, come on. I mean, this is our hope. Our hope is Christ. I don't want to be here in the world when God pours out his wrath on the world. Now, the 7 years comes from Daniel, and if you go back through Daniel and through Revelation, you will find these numbers appearing, and I'm not going to go through it right now, but you will find numbers for 3.5 years, 3.5 years, 42 months, so I forget the number, 1,000 and some days. They all equal 3.5 years. Now, 3.5 years and 3.5 years is 7 years. Okay, I know that's not right. That's part of the 70 weeks of Daniel, the 70th week. That is one last week of years, 7 years. Okay, that is where the 7 years comes from, Daniel 9:24-27. I went through that in detail a few years ago, and I'm going to go through it again when we get to Matthew 21 someday. But that's where the 7 years comes from. The first half of the tribulation is not as bad as the second half. The second half of the tribulation is when Antichrist rules over the whole world and when he persecutes the Jews. Okay, that's Revelation 12. Now, again, I'll say some more about these things, but then at the end of the tribulation, after the 7 years, at the end of the 7 years, Christ returns. He returns in glory. This is Revelation 19. It's Zechariah 14. It's Joel chapter 3. It's Matthew 24. Jesus comes to the earth, destroys the Antichrist and his kingdom, and as it says in Daniel chapter 7, he destroys all the kingdoms of the world and he sets up his own kingdom that is over all the earth. It's Daniel chapter 7. That's the second coming of Christ. When he comes, he will remain on the earth. We will be with him. We will just have spent 7 years with him. We will return with him to the earth, and that will be, he will set his kingdom up on the earth. Okay, and he will reign. He will reign on the throne of David as king in Jerusalem, not only over the Jews, but over the whole world. He will judge in righteousness. He will bring peace. He will end world poverty. He will bring justice. He will be the perfect ruler. Okay. Now, if all you had was the Old Testament, we'd say that was the end. That was it. That was what the Jews thought of as the kingdom. The kingdom was this time when the Messiah would do that. But at the very end of the book of Revelation, in chapter 20 precisely, it's as if God says, wait a minute, let me expand this a little further. That period lasts for 1,000 years, at the end of which there is a rebellion. And then there is the great white throne judgment. This is Revelation 20. It's just taking it totally at face value. So that what you have in the kingdom are, when Christ returns, okay, when Christ comes back at the end of the tribulation, there will be many people still alive on the earth. Unbelievers will be destroyed, but there will be many believers. They will remain on the earth with Christ. They will not be in glorified bodies like the saints that come back with him. They will be people like you and me who have not died and who will die, okay? And who will procreate. And just as there are unbelievers in this world, there will be unbelievers in that era because of the people that procreate. And at the end of the age, there will be a rebellion against Christ's reign. That's what Revelation 20 says. Okay? At the end of that, there will be the great white throne judgment. The great white throne judgment is where everybody will appear. I don't think believers will be there. We will have already been judged at the Bema Seat. All unbelievers will appear before the great white throne, and they will receive their condemnation. And it's at that point when they are thrown into eternal hell. This is Revelation 20, 11 through 15. And then Revelation 21 and 22 speak of the eternal state, which is, of course, heaven for the believers and hell for the unbelievers. Revelation 21 and 22 is mostly speaking of heaven. And in heaven, there will be no temple. The millennium will have a temple, revealed in Ezekiel, right? Heaven will not have a temple because... it says that there will be no sun, there'll be no night. Okay, so it's a whole new paradigm. Now that's kind of again an overview, and I know it's very brief. Does anybody have any questions about that? Yes. 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 Well, Paul says to be apart from the body is to be present with the Lord. There's a bit of a mystery as to actually what happens between now and then, and when I say then, I mean the resurrection. Okay. It would appear that we are in some form of something. We're not just spirits floating around. We're not involved in what some groups like the Seventh-day Adventists speak of, soul sleep and so forth. We are going to be in the Lord's presence as believers the moment we die. Okay, what that is, where that is, what that looks like, I don't know. I only know what the Bible tells me, and I don't. The Bible is not real. Doesn't give a lot of details about that state between now. What it does say plainly in 1 Corinthians 15 and 1 Thessalonians 4 is that when Christ comes in the rapture, all the church will be resurrected. That we will be, in other words, whoever has died, because that was a concern that they had, right? They're going to miss the rapture. What with the people that died? He says, no, those who have died will go up first. Okay, we'll be raised again. And then we will join them. We which are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the air and meet the Lord together in the air. And so shall we ever be with the Lord. That's 1 Thessalonians 4. So the answer is, I'm not sure exactly what it looks like in that interim period, but it is going to be with the Lord. Jerry. Well, new heaven and new earth, you understand heaven is going to incorporate all of... I mean, what happens in the new heaven? Jerusalem descends, right? New heaven and new earth. Now, there are debates over whether that means that he's just going to kind of refurbish this earth, as some people say, and some people say he's going to destroy the old earth and create a whole new thing. I don't know, and it doesn't matter. I just know it's going to be perfect. And it will... By the way, heaven, you know, a lot of people have these visions of heaven, you know, we're going to be on clouds playing harps and things like that. And that's just, you know, that's silly. It's going to be very physical. We're going to be resurrected. We're going to have bodies. We're going to eat. I think the Bible teaches we're going to work. I think the Bible teaches there's going to be government. You know, I don't know what life is going to be like because it's far. I can't even imagine living in a world where there's no sin and where there's perfect relationships, not only between me and God, but between every human being that you'll ever face. Perfect relationship. Can you imagine that? There will be no sadness, no sorrow, no anger, no bitterness, no gossip, no sin of any kind. I mean, I can't even imagine, but that's what it's going to be like. But it's going to be a society. There is apparently going to be economy. There's going to be nations. And I mean, this is what the Old Testament pictures. And whatever life is like here, we're going to look back when we get there, and we're going to say, why was I so enamored with that world? Seriously. This world is like, it's just like that. It's going to be gone. And then it's eternity. Do you know how long eternity is? My daughter keeps saying recently, she, everything is an eternity. I said, Catherine, you don't understand what an eternity is. An eternity is immeasurable. Like when you've been there like 1 billion years, you've only started. You can't even fathom that. Okay, so Daniel. What's that? Yeah, no years. I mean, it's immeasurable. Yes. Yeah, this is the... Yeah, thank you for the advertisement. This is the short version. what I tried to do back then, and hopefully it was helpful, it was a lot of detail, but what I tried to do is go back and show you the key to understanding eschatology is understanding the Old Testament eschatology first. When you understand the Old Testament, which I went through in some detail, obviously, how many messages? 87. Okay. When you understand the Old Testament eschatology, and then you come to the New Testament, okay, which if you have that understanding, you can make sense of the New Testament eschatology. What a lot of people do today, which is completely backwards, is they start with the New Testament, and they go back and try to read it into the Old Testament. And when you do that, you'll get utter confusion. Well, you just can't make sense of details. You just have to kind of broad brush over things in the Old Testament. Say, well, that was just fulfilled in Christ. Well, how? Well, we don't know, but it was fulfilled. I mean, that's really what they say. Okay? I mean, read all that stuff in Ezekiel, and they say, well, I don't know how that was fulfilled, but it was fulfilled. Listen, whenever prophecy is fulfilled, is there any doubt about it? No. It's clear. That's the beauty of it. In fact, that's one reason people try to discredit the book of Daniel, because the prophecies are so clear and so detailed and happen so perfectly. They say, this couldn't be. This can't be. So they say, Daniel had to write after the fact. So Daniel didn't write it. Somebody else wrote it. They do that because it's so clear. It is so obviously fulfilled. All right. Well, I'm out of time. Any other questions? I didn't even address the main issue tonight. But that's okay. We got the foundation. Next week, we will look then at the significance of what's going on in the Middle East. In other words, what is it that connects the Middle East with what the Bible says about his second coming? What is it that we're looking for? What is it that these events are leading toward? Not might, but are leading toward. We'll look at that next week. We have a song to sing, don't we? Perfect song for tonight. Hymn number 667. You may stand as we sing, "To God be the glory," and it is to his glory. 667.